You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back. If you get any opinions on the North Side, what's happened there and what could happen there, 651-461-9226. Send us a text, 651-461-9226. Joining us now, the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline, the one and only Joe Vavra. Joe, I got to tell you, man, you had them on the right track in Detroit, and since you left, they can't hit anymore, man. What happened?
No comment. You know, they're having maybe the worst year in the franchise history. That's what all the reports are saying. That's too bad because some of those guys had such a good start to their career. And, you know, next year, who knows? Or later this year, we'll see what happens. But, you know, the Twins took it to them. Good for the Twins. And here we are.
Yeah, some of the statistics indicate it's the worst offensive year since 1904. In the big leagues, depending on what stat you use. Now, if you have guys that are going bad like that, you've been through this, where you have a team, and a team's in a slump, whatever, where do you start when it seems to be kind of contagious? How do you start getting guys so that you start to generate offense and you get up around 5-6 runs a game if you can?
Well, there's usually no quick fixes, but if you get too in-depth with guys, they'll never come out of it. So there's a lot of, you know, idiosyncrasy things they can try. And but, you know, when you got a whole lineup going bad, it's tough. I used to like to just try to have three guys going good. They could carry the ball club, and then, you know, a couple guys do okay, and then, you know, or maybe three guys going. So three guys in the lineup aren't doing that well, and they're the ones you really concentrate on. But you can't forget the guys that are going hot, because as soon as you turn your back on them in a work day, then all of a sudden they tank. So it's all about the process. If you're dedicated to your routine and it makes sense, and it really is, you know, it's a progression type thing in hitting. And, you know, if you see, you take them, hey, we're right here, we want to get up here. You know, we got to stay with this progress to get up there. And so if you can get them to buy into that and it makes sense, and it's really their routine, because you don't want to have it say, hey, that's Joe Bobber's routine. No, it's your routine. You name it, you do it. And if you like it, we're going to continue it. And then, hey, take the lows the way they are, you know, the highs will start coming. So you see a little bloop here, a cracked bat, and one that falls in front of the mound, he can't feel it, you're on your way.
Yeah, just get something going. So that brings us to, and Joe Vavra is our guest, a former hitting coach for the Minnesota Twins and Detroit Tigers. And speaking of, you know, how do you bring a guy out of a slump? How do you recognize if you're even in a slump? Sometimes you're hitting the ball well and you're just not getting hits. Miguel Sano, I would venture to guess they'll bring him back tomorrow against Milwaukee. His rehab assignment is up with the St. Paul Saints. And you worked with Miguel some. And, I mean, he has been all over the map in terms of as a hitter and what he can do and guessing. And man, when he hits it, it goes far. And everybody goes, well, God, I love watching the threat, and I love the threat of him. But, man, he strikes out a lot. Why does he strike out so much?
Well, you know, he wants the big bombs. I mean, he wants to put in the seats. He wants to swing out of his, you know what. And that's hard to control the barrel, to keep the barrel in the zone. You know, I've seen that guy when he's so good, and then I've seen him so when he's so bad. And when he's so bad, they just consistently pound him with the same thing, and yet he don't make the adjustments. So it's hard to tone down those swings we talked about in the last time I was on. You know, these guys, you know, they're hitting to the shifts, and they don't care because they want to launch and all that stuff. And, you know, you just see him. It's really hard to slow down the barrel. I call the middle neutral, and then once you find a contact point to hit the ball at the middle, you can kind of take off a little bit to go the other way, or you can get out in front to pull. But that middle is kind of your stabilizer for everything. And you know, he has a hard time with that. He's so big now. He's so heavy, so thick. This is a monster of a guy, and he just has a hard time slowing it down. But I saw him at the Saints game about a week or so ago. I went up there for a game, and he actually a couple good at bats, you know. Looked like he was the same old guy, but I haven't seen him since. So it's one of those things. When he gets hot, he'll carry the ball club.
So do you, with a guy like that, you know he's going to swing as hard as he can. Do you just tell him to guess? Just go ahead and guess on every pitch, because if you guess right, the rest will take care of itself. And I don't, it's not working doing it the other way. So you just say, just guess every pitch?
No, I never tell him. Like, I can't tell anybody to guess. I'm from the non-strikeout area.
I know. That's why this is so complicated to watch, you know?
I can't handle guys that don't just, they walk back to the bench with, you know, and it's no big deal. I just can't handle that. You didn't. You just took three pitches down the middle, and you're sitting on a slider. Oh, way to go! Are you happy? I don't get it. No, I don't go up there and guess. And you know, maybe the outcome would be the same. Might be better. Who knows? You know, that's what a lot of the analytical guys say. Hey, you're going to sit on this pitch, and it's too hard to guess counts. You know. To me, the guys get overwhelmed when you start going, hey, oh, he's going to throw this. Probably the easiest count to remember. You know, it gets to 0-1, you're going to do this. 0-1, oh, he's going to do this. 1-1. They can't digest it. They're looking at way too many pitches on the pitching staff now. Sure. To try to compute all that stuff. So, but they do know the guy's strength. And if you're watching, you're paying attention, you see that he's not getting a slider over. He's not getting over right-handers. He's doing okay with lefties. You watch. You know, you watch his pitches. You start cutting them off and see, you know, fastball, riding fastball, check. He goes for a strike. Slider down the way out of the zone. Lay off of it. That's hard to do when some guys guess the pitch really good, and they commit to it because they guess it right. And it might not even be close. It might bounce. But they guessed it right. They saw a spin. They saw, you know, that's just what.
Who was the best you ever saw at game day in-game adjustments in terms of being able to process that quickly?
Well, you got a couple of, like Maurer and Morneau. Obviously, they were really good about, you know, watching each other's bats, and you know, Span was good. I'm talking about the guys that had coming up through was pretty darn good. And, you know, Cabrera he was fine, and he come back from surgery in 2020 when they had him at that COVID year. He's come back from surgery and kind of no fans in the stand and stuff like that. But he makes the adjustment per pitch, and he doesn't necessarily sit on one pitch, but there's a number of guys that have been making. I like the rise, man. That guy was getting to him. And he doesn't even have to, you know, he's not going to be a guy that's going to get kind of fooled by, you know, kind of get it set up, I should say. He's not going to get set up pretty good because he goes back to neutral. He goes back to, you know, looking for the ball probably down the middle of the plate and saying, hey, 2 feet, 2 inches outside, I can go with it. 2 inches inside, you know, way inside, fight it off if it's a strike. So, you know, he battles. He's just fun to watch. And incidentally, my Cleveland the other night, I turned on MLB.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just have a hard time watching, you know, like the highlights, because it's all home run, home
yeah,
run,
yep,
home
yep,
run.
Yep.
And I was totally taken back when I watched the other night, and was hit after hit after hit after hit after hit after hit. And that was Cleveland. They had all the soft singles, whatever, score runs, battling, high fastballs, fighting them off. And then they went right to Arise. Bam, base hit, scores a winner, nice goings.
Now Arise, you know, he was a decent hitter coming through, but all of a sudden he skyrocketed this year. Is that one more adjustment that he made, or how do you explain a guy taking that quantum leap?
You know, a lot of times the league don't overwhelm them, and if they can battle when they're young and fight off and give good at bats, maybe their average and stuff isn't very good, but doesn't overwhelm them. They'll make the adjustments. You know, there's you got quite a few guys on that club that are going to be that way. You know, like a Polanco, probably. He didn't get overwhelmed. Didn't necessarily do that great, but he just, you know, early on had the soft one. Didn't really put in the seats, but now he's a mature baseball player, major league player. He can move the ball around, and, you know, he's better from one side to the other, but he's tough. He's not an easy out. So,
okay, yeah, and I always, because Polanco's one of those guys, when he comes up, you feel like, okay, we want this guy up right now because he's going to give you a quality at bat, because, as you mentioned, he doesn't get overwhelmed, and there's a chance he could do something with it and put it out of the park, or at least if he hit a gap. Byron Buxton was an all-star, and certainly the home runs are there, but he also only hit .216 in the first half of the season. What do you see when you see him? Because you talk about hot and cold. You'll go, yeah. Golly, he had that great two home runs, and then you look and you go, yeah, and he's in 0-16. 2016 slump. He's had that kind of a year. What do you see?
Well, you know what? Last year, before he got injured, he was that MVP type candidate, mm-hmm. I believe. I don't get to watch him every night like I used to, but I just think he made the adjustment. The slider is not an enemy anymore. If it hangs, he's got it. He gets the barrel out front. Maybe doesn't have to utilize his speed so much, but boy, the ball's in the gaps. You know, it's easy triples for him. So, he's just getting the barrel out there. I think average. Yeah, could he hit a little better? But
is that because he punishes you when you make a mistake, but he still hasn't mature enough where he can beat you if you throw your best pitch?
Yeah, he's close. So, you know, you saw it last year whether he was there. There was no doubt about it. And it comes and goes, but, you know, it's probably there more times than it's not. And, you know, he's making the adjustments. So that's one thing that, you know, when he was really going bad, it never got to him. Not bad anyway. Not outwardly. Maybe internally he was ready to come off the bridge, but he was pretty good on the outside. You know, just I'm going to get him tonight or tomorrow night. I'm going to get the guy. No problem. So.
And sometimes we do forget. Like Torrey Hunter matured a lot as a hitter over the years, didn't he?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, Torrey didn't like the ball inside,
mm-mm.
You know, and it was visible to everybody, all fans, and everything, that he just didn't like the ball upside, which really set him up for pitches away. They teased him in, and you know, once he started figuring out those are all setups, they're for show, and I'll just be able to cover that plate. He could use the whole field, and he could hit for power, and, you know, there's a perennial all-star Gold Glover that had, you know, the confidence, you know, to the moon and back on his defense. And, you know, those type of guys, if they excel on one side of the sport, of the field, like Buxton,
yeah.
Their offense is going to come around because they're going to get enough opportunity and they're going to be able to have a lot of chances. So,
yep.
You know, they just excel on one side and then pretty soon the offense starts to come along because, hey, you got to have that defense out there and this guy's going to be a monster someday. And well enough, he does.
Big Poppy, David Ortiz, you competed against many times, and I'm sure as a hitting coach, you watched him closely. And, you know, I knew him here in Minnesota, and obviously, he his career becomes Hall of Fame. We all know the story. What was he all about? I mean, a big guy like that doesn't run well, that can hit for that kind of average. Explain that.
Well, Big Poppy, he had a good foundation. You know, he came up with the Twins. He knew how to hit the ball, use the whole field. So that was always in his back pocket. I think as you'll notice, maybe he's pulled up some videos, you know, when he turned his foot in so he didn't have to probably pivot as far. That's a mechanical thing, you know.
Yep.
He didn't have to pivot that backside so much. He's a big dude, and he doesn't have to pivot a full 90 degrees to get the barrel out on the pull side. So he puts it in, you know, he toes it in, and he has to pivot 45. He's a lot quicker. And all of a sudden, fastballs and stuff are easy because he doesn't have all that turn, and his hands were lightning. They were... You're really good. He was a really good hitter with Minnesota. I think the knee issue was kind of a deal for him. And, you know, there was some doubt about his career because maybe his health. But, man, you know, I think because he was groomed well early on, I think that set the stage for him to be confident, you know, that he could go the other way in Fenway Park or, hey, I can pull all day long. So, you know, I think he went into the right situation, right ballpark, and, you know, the rest is history. Good for him.
Carlos Correa can hit for power, and he can do some different things for you. I've been really impressed with him as a baseball player, especially how strong his arm is. Like, holy cow, I couldn't believe that. That's 105-mile-an-hour fastball when he needs it from the shortstop position. But as a hitter, he's long and lanky. I mean, he looks like an athlete. When he steps out on the field, you say that's got to be the best player on the field. He's got that look and that it about him. What do you see from him? This is the first time I've watched him, obviously, multiple at-bats.
Well, his hands are always ready. They're always in the right spot. You know, he doesn't take it. You know, there's no extra at the top. The hands are ready. They're loaded, you know, so the ball's out of the pitcher's hand. He's recognizing it. He doesn't go backwards from there. So everything's forward. He's been kind of on fire. He's been a catalyst lately, from what I've been seeing.
Yeah.
And, you know, some long balls and, you know, left center in the deep part of the ballparks. And he's been doing that guy. But then I look at the dugout and I see how he is as a teammate. And just the players rally around him. You know, he'll sit on the bench and he'll talk to three or four players after he has a big home run or a big hit or something like that. Or maybe they did and he'll America. So he's, you know, that goes a long ways as far as his character, helping young guys, helping veterans. He's a veteran now. He kind of passing it back and forth. But I'm more impressed what he does after he goes back to the, he doesn't sit and sulk and, you know, he gets over it. He's been through the wars.
All right, last question. I saw a father and a son, or maybe it was the coach, I don't know, at a ballpark the other day, and the kid had like a stick. Now, I mean, it was a baseball bat grip, but it was made for this, and it's more like a stick than it is a bat. And he was throwing him little plastic golf balls, and I thought that has got to be perfect for hand-eye coordination. Is that a great drill for somebody to do? Will the ball always seem big if you can handle a plastic golf ball with a stick?
No doubt about it. No doubt. I mean, that's why the old wiffle ball had such a, you know,
yeah,
bigger ball, little tiny bat, and the idea was that you square it up with that, you know. So, heck, Tony Bautista, I mean, he had me down before the games flipping in popcorn seats.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Popcorn seats. He'd square them popcorn seats up, and I'm going,
he'd do a soft toss with popcorn seats.
Oh, yeah, before every game. Come down, he'd pull out his back pocket, his pants, hand me a handful of seeds.
Wow.
And I'd be flipping them popcorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't make that up. It's pretty good, you know. He had the most eccentric type of batting stance. I guess maybe he needed that, but, yeah.
Well, that day you hit three at Target Field, kaboom, kaboom, kaboom. I said, there you go. I can see why you like him, you know.
He's all right. So, yeah.
Hey, Joe, appreciate it very much. Hope we can tap into you, but I love talking hitting with you.
All right, Mike. And you know what? I'm just out here. I'm enjoying a little bit of old time country music at some Riverside Park or something like that in Altoona, Wisconsin. You know, just enjoying the night.
Okay, well,
night.
Don't get too old too quick on us, okay? You're not that old.
Heck no.
No, you sit down at the park and listen to country music, okay? All right, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, waiting for some new stuff. See
ya. Bye. My wife and I were commenting the other day about how we've been taken watching squirrels in the backyard, how funny it is to watch them, and it is funny to watch them. But we wondered out loud if that was the beginning of the end. When you're entertained by squirrels, you know what I'm saying? Carlos Correa, what he does for a team, I'll explain it in layman's terms when we come back. There are different leaders, different leadership styles that work. We had Larry McKenzie on earlier. That podcast is up wherever we post them. It's there. And his style, you know, he needed to be have his thumb on the pulse and know everything about his players. And obviously, for Major League Baseball players, different. But Carlos Correa came into the clubhouse this spring. And before he did his press conference and all those things, he sat and engaged with the players, almost went down the locker row. I watched this at spring training. But before that, when they had come to town to play the Twins 2 years ago in the playoffs, in the COVID year when nobody could be there, and they played them in the playoffs in the afternoon in October, I didn't know anything about him. And I got there early and I sat and watched him. And I said, this is one of the most natural leaders I've ever seen. He went out to play shortstop and everybody knew where he was, and his attention, you know, he commanded attention without really having to work at it. And I see that's one style of leadership. Byron Buxton, it's not natural for him to lead. This is not what he does. His whole life, he's been a tremendous athlete, and he's put up numbers, and he could run, and he could do all these things. And so for him, it requires more effort. He's got to think about it more. And his style is, you know, to use the hand motions after a triple and things like that to pump it up and to celebrate when somebody does something well. But it's much more difficult for him. It's not a natural extension of his personality. He's getting $105 million, so he feels an obligation now to lead. And you can do that. It's just a lot different. For Correa, you get the sense that he was doing this when he was on the Little League team and probably doing it for guys that were 2 years older than him, and he just had that gift and that understanding of who needed to be cheered up and who needed to be jacked up, as they say. And that just – continued to follow him through his whole career. And Buxton was just, you know, he was just so good. He was so electric. He could have played football. He played baseball. And I remember doing a story on him when he was in Iowa in the minor leagues. And he was not an extrovert. And then he came here and obviously he got humbled a little bit, with the expectations and everything else. Always a nice guy. And then he got to be, just kind of a regular guy. And then they said, Byron, you got to be the leader on this team because we're going to give you $105 million. And then I'm not saying he changed for the better or the worse. It's just different. He's trying to assume the role of leadership. And I bring this up because it's so interesting to study. And the question that I ask myself sometimes with Byron, for example, is, do they really want you to lead? Do you really need to lead? Or can you just play the game well and let them pick up on that? I don't know. But sometimes I think you can waste energy trying to be so aware of being a leader because you get paid the most money. And you really don't have to. They'll lead. They'll follow you in the areas that they want to follow you in, and there's not much you can do about that. That's what I'm saying. Tomorrow, training camp starts for the Minnesota Vikings, and this is where we bridge this thing. When we come back, one of the all-time great leaders in Vikings history will join us. Sports to the Max rolls on after this. Welcome back, Sports to the Max. Tomorrow I'll be the Minnesota Vikings to cover them as training camp begins. It is a time-honored tradition. It used to be held in Mankato, before that Bemidji, and depending on where you played, you usually went to a college for training camp. Now it's right on-site at facilities. Joining us in the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline, the man that knows all about it. Bob Lertzema, what did training camp mean to you? Were you excited the night before training camp or not?
Absolutely. We had a blast in training camp. We'd sneak out at night, go over to...
No, you're ruining my perception of you guys.
No. The training camp, it was fun. I mean, you made it fun if you came into camp in shape. In other words, the off season, a lot of these guys came to camp to get in shape. I came in camp in shape to learn the defense, and that's why a lot of athletes, probably better than me, didn't make it because of their attitude towards training camp. But we get there with the guys, and everything. It was people, I think, picture how cruel it is, but it's not. You're playing something you really love, every day, and you can grade yourself every day. A lot of times in the business world, it takes, you have a yearly goal.
Sure.
Well, here you got a goal, a daily goal, and then they show the films the next morning or whatever, when you're corrected there. So, I liked it. I really did.
So some say that this training camp nowadays in the NFL, they're too short and too soft. Three preseason games and they don't hit. Do you think that's true, or is that just because these guys stay in such great shape and they got so many training camps in the off season that they don't need it?
No, don't give me all the great shape that they're in. No, there's all the things that you said, how much tougher the camps are. No, it's not true. They mislead you.
Yeah.
And the players have too much to say about what they're going to do.
Really?
In camp, and as far as the number of one-on-one pass drills you have and
yeah.
the contact.
Yeah.
We started out every practice, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We started out Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, excuse me. We started out every practice, with live blitz pickup.
Really?
Every
live.
Practice. I mean, we dug in, and that's the way we started it. And if you didn't like it, adios, I'll cut you.
So would you be, would it be first against first? Would it be you guys against Tarkenton? What would it be?
Yeah, well, we weren't allowed to tackle Tarkenton. We just could touch him.
Yeah.
Because he's the golden boy.
You played with him in New York and Minnesota, so you knew him well.
Yeah. I played 10 years as a friend. He's a piece of work. But
I wish I'd have bought that Apple stock when he bought that Apple stock. I can tell you that.
Oh man, you know, I had a chance to it, but then that's the time I went out and bought you dinner rather than buy the stock.
I know, and I told you, man, this thing Apple that I haven't heard much about might be okay. But anyway, you couldn't hit him. But the point was, you had a lot of contact in practice.
Yep. Yeah, because we started out with the 15 to 20 minutes of live blitz pickup. That's where we started practice, because you wanted to get that tempo going. You know, you didn't want to come out there and think you're going full speed, but you really, you know, you're faking your way through all these drills. When you go live blitz pickup, there's no way to fake it. They can tell exactly, you know, who has the attitude, you know, to carry over day in and day out.
Okay.
Because you don't have an attitude of just Sundays only.
No way.
And a lot of these young punk kids, they come in, they think they just have to get it up, you know, on Saturday, you know, for the college. And,
yeah.
And Sunday for the pros.
Yeah.
Not the way it works, Matt.
Take a guy like Danielle Hunter. Great player, and then he's been hurt the last couple of years. Does he have that in him? Do you see him being kind of a raging bull when he needs to?
I'm a positive person.
Okay.
I don't like to answer this question. But, you know, he's got all the talent in the world, right?
Uh-huh.
But he does not try and give it 100% on every play. And that's the greatest thing an athlete can have, because if you as an athlete are playing, we'll say defensive end like me, and you're not given 100% on every play, how can I as a coach you?
Because you don't know what you're going to get from him.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's coming at 80%. Well, that opens up one other weakness, and you try to correct that, you know, and there's no consistency. Predictability is the greatest thing to have for a professional team, knowing how a player is going to react in a certain situation, whether they come out with a different formation, whether a split formation, I formation, no backs in the backfield. It's how they make the adjustments and their attitude throughout their career, you know, and all week will give you that positivity.
All right, Bob, they've got a new coaching staff that obviously they've been with them in the offseason, and it starts tomorrow. You went through different coaching staffs, and you had some legendary ones. Bud Grant, Don Shula you played for, Jack Patera later on in Seattle, all those things. What do players expect from their coaches? And they talk a lot about this being a real positive group of coaches. Will that last, or is that just something that gets you into the door?
That'll get you in the door, but then to stay, they have got to coach. They have to understand the players and be able to coach their weakness.
Yep.
And also understand when you do make a mistake, what was Lertzi seeing? You know.
Yep.
Did the halfback go in motion? Was it split formation? You know, because what we would do, when we watch the tapes, We look even at the end zone tapes, and we check out the offensive lineman. Now, remember, I'm defensive lineman. We check out the offensive line, the opposing team upcoming, and we do close-ups of their feet. And then you could find out if their right foot on the right-footed stand was back four more inches.
You know it was a pass.
No. When it's back, they're going to get off. It's just the opposite, Mackie.
Oh, I see when they put it out wide.
Yeah, that's
it's pass. Yep.
Yes. But when you're doing the same thing in the back, you know that's going to give them a better opportunity to get off the ball.
Right. So what you're saying is those coaches have to be able to. You can be as positive as you want, but the bigger thing is they got to make you a better player, and that's what you really want.
Right. When I make a mistake, of course I never did. I was perfect.
No.
But when you do it, why did Bob do that? The coach has to see that. that the offensive tackle was 3 inches closer to the guard. So I anticipate this particular play being a seasoned veteran. And it came down to that fine detail.
Yeah.
Where you see a guy up, same thing, they all of a sudden he's off a little bit. Boom, red flag goes up.
Yep, bing.
And then what we used to do with L.R. Marshall and Page, you know, we'd have a fake call. If we knew we were going to get killed, you know, and they were going to block down, we go, Maxie, you know. And then that was our call between the linemen. Jack, defense line coach, nothing the Vikes. And great coach, I love that. Yeah. But they that's how we would do it. But they trusted us. If you come off the defense that was called, you better be 100% correct.
100%, yep.
Right, but see, here's the deal: a veteran player and a veteran coach, you know, if they're on the same page, that's like poetry.
It's such a great
thing to see him perform.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Lurchie, appreciate it very much. I look forward to seeing you at training camp, my friend.
Oh, you bet. Hey, man, and everybody out there, Cousins is good.
Yeah.
Don't read any negative stuff about him. And Vikes are going to have a good year this year.
That's all I need to hear. I will sleep well tonight. Thank you, Lurchie.
Okay, it's fine, Maxie.
You bet. I love that guy, Bob Lurtzma, man. I love that guy, Bob Lurtzma. I sound like Bernsey now. But he had Mooney Winston behind him, too. And Mooney made up for more mistakes. He could put him in the right position all the time. Because Mooney just say, Bob, you know, look, they're coming this way. And then, boom, you knew. Because Mooney was, he was just there. I've been there a long time. And if you get a guy like Mooney, it's a little bit different. It just is. And Bob had the benefit of that while he was here. Bob was actually, they called him bench warmer Bob. He made all that money doing that. He was a really good football player. He was the fifth defensive lineman on the best defensive line in the NFL with Page and Eller and Larson and God rest his soul, Sudsy, Doug Sutherland, who always looked up to Bob as kind of his role model and passed away this past offseason as well. I should ask Bob about him. I forgot to. Training camp for the Minnesota Vikings, what to watch out for when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back, Sports to the Max, News Talk 830 WCCO. Tomorrow night right here will be occupied by the Minnesota Twins as they take on the Milwaukee Brewers. Pretty good collection of players they've got east of this city in Milwaukee. They are in first place in the National League in their division. And they give you a handful. They can pitch the baseball. They can. And then when you got haters sitting at the end of it, it becomes a very, very difficult task. But they will play tomorrow, and then on Wednesday afternoon, then they'll fly out and play in San Diego over the weekend. We'll wait to see if Miguel Sano is a part of that equation. Training camp, what to watch for the Minnesota Vikings? How do they use KJ Osborne? Be very, very important. The defensive line rotation, particularly in the middle with some of the new players they've got. Is Harrison Phillips going to be a gap stopper? Is he going to be a situation guy, or can he play more downs than we think right now? How athletic are their new linebackers? Can Hicks give them the boost that they need? Those are the things that you watch for coming right out of the gate. Now the second part of that is everybody's going to be watching is the new coaching staff. And what can they get out of, you know, a lot of the same players from the same team? Do you know what the most underrated thing is for a football coach? Without question. This is based on my year. I played it in high school. My brothers played it in high school and college. I've studied coaches in football for years. I've gotten to know football coaches for years. And we talk so much about X's and O's and motivation as being, you know, you X and O, or you're a motivator. And if you're really good, you're both. And no question, those things are critical. But you know the one thing that is incredibly underrated in terms of the quality of a football coach in particular, because there's so many moving parts, it is who is the most organized. Who is the most organized? Who can get it down to a minute with clarity as to what you're doing on your practice schedule? Who can make it so clear that it can't be misinterpreted? Who can get in front of players and say, this is what we're doing at this time on this day, and everybody in the room knows exactly what they're doing at that time on that day? You don't think about this very often. But the greatest football coaches that I know are incredibly organized. That means they're doing things like in March, they're planning the training camp schedule day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute. They've got it down. These players want clarity. They want to know exactly how their schedule lays out for the next 6 months of their lives, and they want to know every day what that schedule looks like. The most organized wins because the most organized provides the most clarity. These players got enough to think about without having to worry about what time is the meeting at. All they got to be able to do is look on their iPad and see the meeting is at 7:35. Don't be late. That's all they need to know, but they need to know that, and that coaches have to be so organized. We don't talk about that very often. You don't think about that very often. But the great coaches at all, in high school especially, the coach that communicates the best in the off season and explains what it is he's trying to get done with this program. Today I was at a high school football practice. You now have windows of time where people can go out and practice football. You have X amount of days during the summer. And so you need to be highly organized because it's an optional practice. You don't know how many kids are going to show up, and you want them to know the basics so that when they get to their version of training camp, you can start with it. You can hit with your feet running and you're going in the same direction. And so the only way you can do that is to be incredibly organized. In this practice that I was watching, they were incredibly organized because they communicated to the kids. Okay, on this day, you're just going to wear helmets. The next day, you're going to just wear helmets and shoulder pads and on. But you knew exactly what time you needed to be there. You knew exactly what time the whistle was going to blow to start it. You knew exactly what time it was going to end. You knew exactly what you were going to do. We don't think about that, do we? We think about, can they give the old Newt Rockne speech? And, can they figure out how to use the flanker? The most organized is one of the greatest attributes you can have as a head football coach. When we come back, this is interesting. She grew up in Pardon Me, Dina, went on to work as a reporter at the New York Times, and she's always had this affinity for sports and a guy named Tony Oliva, so much so that she boycotted going to the Hall of Fame until yesterday when she got four seats to see Tony Oliva go in. We will visit with her about her storied career and what Tony Oliva means to her next.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.